There's a notion that resident coordinators are first accountable to government. As UNHCR, as a humanitarian, you deeply believe your first accountability is to people. You're not always right. It's a hard thing to accept when you go up the echelons of leadership and of responsibility. I've had protection as my compass, because protection is this reminder that I'm not doing this for me. I'm not doing this for New York or Geneva. I'm doing this because I'm expected by people. So if protection is your compass, you'll be a very influential, impactful leader.
Protection leadership means ensuring that the safety, the dignity, and the rights of the people affected by humanitarian crises guide every decision we make. Humanitarian leaders in field operations need to work together to advocate and to keep attention firmly on those most at risk. Protection is everybody's business. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Protection Leadership. I am delighted to have with me today Louise Aubin, the UNHCR representative in Malaysia, and a colleague and a friend I've known for many, many years. Louise has spent her entire career on protection leadership. She has navigated coups, she has gone through crises, she has really worked in challenging environments in many parts of the world, building a reputation, one of the strongest advocates for refugee rights in the system. Louise, while we're preparing for this discussion, for this podcast, you mentioned to me that the term centrality of protection was something that you actually came up and you wrote down in the back of a napkin in the cafeteria of the office while the policy was being designed. Can you tell me a little bit more about this story?
Well, I should have kept that napkin, Thanos. It was at a time when I was double-hatting. I was both a deputy director in the Division of International Protection at UNHCR, but I was also the Global Protection Cluster coordinator. So I had a very broad view of the humanitarian system. And I had this feeling that there was an assumption that in the field, when there was a protection gap or a protection problem, that protection actors as a sector were sufficient to address it. And when the protection gap persisted or a new one emerged, it was the fact that protection actors, the sector, was not doing its job. I needed to have all humanitarian actors think about, what does it take to prevent violence? Or what does it take to ensure safe, equitable humanitarian access? What is the role of different sectors in contributing to a safer environment for displaced people, people affected by crisis? So in essence, it was about trying to have humanitarian actors see protection as a shared responsibility and without being abstract. So that's the idea behind the original, and I dare say the year 2013, IASC, Interagency Standing Committee statement on the centrality of protection. On that napkin, I was, having coffee with a few NGO colleagues, and I drew a bullseye on the napkin, and that was people, you know, at the center of a crisis, saying what they needed or what protection meant to them. And then I drew some arrows and a few more bubbles, and that corresponded to the different actors and their interventions. And it seemed like everything was converging to that one bullseye point. The whole reason why people felt unsafe or why they felt trapped in a crisis. The idea of protection needed to be very federative, bring everyone around the table. So I think there are three dimensions to protection, Panos. I think you can't deny we need sector experts. We need people who are protection experts and who deal with separated children and trying to reunify them with their families. I think we need specialists that look at sexual violence in conflict. I think we need agencies that focus on, you know, documenting displaced people. A second dimension, though, is how we act and how we do our work as a humanitarian broad coalition of actors. So how people focused on food or shelter, etc., ingest, if you will, a way of ensuring that they deliver their programs, their projects in a way that is protective, that does no harm. So we, the mainstreamed dimension of protection. And then the third dimension is probably what we're thinking about and need to think about mostly, is the purpose of humanitarian action. People have to feel safer after humanitarian interventions. People have to feel that their life is in better control, that there's an outcome to this that will take them out of crisis. So it doesn't diminish at all the very specialized work of various sectors. It just brings it together to a single focus. And in that statement, we recognize that, you know, the leadership, for example, the humanitarian coordinator needs to bring this together. So yeah, the napkin has a bit of a history. I might need to try to find it and frame it at some point.
Thank you. Thanks, Louise, for sharing the napkin with the multi-dimensions. And really, as you said, is about the safety, the dignity, the rights of the people we serve that really remain at the center, at the heart of everything we do, and in particular for leaders. But can I ask you, when people talk about centrality of protection, often they find it a term that is difficult to grasp and even more difficult to apply it in practice. Can you give us an example, or can you tell us a little bit more about how do I apply it? If I'm a senior leader working in any part of the world, practically, what do I do to bring it forward?
One thing is for sure, debating protection in Geneva or New York, I can imagine that protection is hard to grasp. It becomes very real, and priorities seem very clear and sharp, as you know, Panos, because you've worked in humanitarian situation. In crisis, things become very sharply in focus. And I think the difficulty is that in crises, people are not only deprived of material needs. That's the visible part. But they also face threats to life, threats to safety, freedom, to dignity. And that's the invisible part, but people feel it. So they tell you about this, but it doesn't necessarily come immediately to mind. If you're not a protection specialist, you're kind of wondering, well, what do I do about this? I bring food, or I bring medicine, I bring water, but these people are talking about something else. So there's not a single actor that's responsible for threats to life or threats to freedom or dignity. It really needs to be about building an environment together, addressing the most singular vulnerabilities among populations, but in an environment where everyone is watching out for what people are describing, those threats that are, like I say, are not readily visible. If I may bring about a singular issue, is like some displaced people are getting actually enough humanitarian assistance. They are getting enough food. Well, there's never enough food. There's never adequate enough shelter. But we seem to be able to bring about the basics. But they are still concerned about the safety of their child in that environment, or they're wanting to move away to a place that seems safer. Those are all things that not one single agency mandate can actually dictate. It really does require a whole coalition of actors to be able to work out what needs to be done.
That coalition of actors and kind of this collective, collaborative leadership, which is so much needed in our sector. But can I bring you back to where you are? You're currently the representative for UNHCR in Malaysia. And I wanted to ask you, what does protection look like for you? Also this year in particular, where it's a year where there have been so serious funding cuts. So if you can tell us, how do you go about it at the time with everything else going on?
I think like everyone, you know, your question could be spun into, how do you make decisions when there are no good options? Or how do you prioritize when everything seems so urgent and critical? Without funding, you're really stripped bare of some of those essential tools that we use in humanitarian or refugee protection work. I think a lesson, a very immediate lesson, particularly for myself, I'm leading a purely mandate operation for UNHCR. So we're, despite the fact that we're in an upper middle income country, UNHCR is doing all of the registration, the documentation of refugees. We are at the center of, you know, coalitions of civil society, et cetera, to build protection space. In a situation like this, you're reminded, though, of the bigger picture. The bigger picture is a crisis that is hitting not UNHCR in Malaysia. It's a global crisis where humanitarian actors, development actors are stripped of some of those essential tools to be able to effect change. So when I advocate for budget replenishment here in Malaysia, or I advocate for less cuts in staffing. I mean, we've had 65% of our staff here leave us just in the past few months. When I advocate for that, I have to keep in mind, wait a second. I think I have to think about what Malaysia represents in terms of a contribution to protection or asylum space in a broader space in Asia. And there I have the advocacy points I want. I need to maintain some presence of UNHCR here in Malaysia because we need that pressure point to move Malaysia in adopting, for example, what is so crucial, a national asylum system. Or we need to move Malaysia as the leader, the chair this year of ASEAN, to mobilize other states to agree a collaborative arrangement for safe disembarkation of boats that are carrying refugees and migrants as well. So the bigger picture, I think, is a reminder that no one country addresses humanitarian or refugee needs. We need broader space, so we need a lot of collaboration also among UNHCR representatives in the region and beyond, and among, you know, development actors, humanitarian actors, with those traditional and less traditional donors. So I think the lesson here is everything is interlinked, and we either all move forward or we all sink.
No, indeed, everything is interlinked, and the level of complexity we see really in operations has significantly increased. Talking of this and looking at, I mean, you're in a context of a mixed migration. There's so many issues that are taking place. So how do you prioritize and how do you, you know, how do you choose among so many things in times of constraints, what to put first and how to move forward?
When I intercede with government authorities, and frankly, with my sister UN agencies, I distill the point down to its most essential. What distinguishes refugees from migrants? It's the no safe return option. That is the distinguishing factor. We have 90% of refugees here from Myanmar, but we have 50 some nationalities represented in those 10%. So it's sometimes difficult for authorities to try to distinguish, you know, who's a migrant, who's a refugee. And as you may know, Malaysia hasn't signed the 1951 Convention, does not have a national asylum system. So the conflation is easy between migrants and refugees. But keeping protection very much at the forefront of advocacy, when I explain why it is that we need to document refugees, because I need to make sure that the authorities are clear about who they owe protection to. Migrants have needs, and this is where you see opportunities, perhaps for increasing the well-being of refugees in Malaysia. They have a lot in common with migrants, undocumented migrants in Malaysia. We can find, and it's actually a point of a project here between UNHCR, IOM, and a donor, is to build livelihoods training for both migrants and refugees, because the opportunity there is to show that they have similar needs here in Malaysia. But always remembering that the centrality of protection here is quite helpful. Why am I distinguishing refugees from migrants? It's about that. It's about making sure that no one is mistakenly returned to a place where their life or rights are in danger, that distinguishing factor. So I look for opportunities in commonalities, and I distinguish categories of people when it makes a difference to their life, to their protection. So I think keeping protection central in discourse avoids conflating issues and solutions.
Thank you, Louise. Kind of this distinction on protection, I guess looking at severity and really what's the most critical and important is very important. I want to ask you about your influencing approach. I mean, Malaysia is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention. It is an upper middle income country, as you said. And of course, there are, as in many countries, there are internally, it has its own kind of political sensitivities with everything that is going on. So how do you build influence and trust? I mean, building trust with the government is crucial, and with counterparts in this environment to bring your influencing strategy. How do you go about it?
To be honest, I think these days, whether a country has signed the 1951 convention or not, it seems to be a particular challenge when you're carrying the mandate of protecting refugees and trying to convince why asylum matters. This day and age is extremely difficult and, dare I even say, hostile to the issue of asylum. But nonetheless, I think here it's a good point to raise. I think UNHCR staff have developed some pretty good political skills because of that. I think sometimes we underestimate the extent to which we're negotiating politically for space, for access, for rights, in ways that do not confront countries who've either made the choice or neglected for various reasons to sign the 51 Convention or to have a functional asylum system. And I think we need to treat all those countries both with respect, but to say also, we're here to tell you what you don't necessarily want to hear, but which would help you in the long term to manage the very real reality that people are on the move. People move for various reasons. And those who move because they expect and need protection, well, I think a country that is mindful of its sovereignty, a country that is mindful of, you know, needing to know who's in the country and for what reason, would have every reason to invest in a national asylum system. So that's a little bit what we're tackling with. Of course, it is harder when there are no legal frameworks to deal with refugees or that recognize or even criminalize asylum. So I feel we're developing some really savvy ways of drawing on legal, cultural, religious references that are particular to Malaysia and to the region to try to influence and hit the right note. There's so many examples here in Malaysia where we've really made a difference. And it is probably around the work we do on social cohesion. When we can address tensions between local communities and refugees where they live by drawing on what brings them together, either the practice of a religious rite. I mean, Rohingya refugees are a majority group here in Malaysia as refugees. So there's a lot in common with Malaysians, Malay, who practice Islam. So we've been able to draw on leadership of religious actors. We've also been able to draw on culture. There are many cultural references and leaders in the cultural field that actually have the courage to speak out and attenuate. What we've been seeing is a lot of hate speech against refugees. So I think despite the absence of legal frameworks that are explicitly protecting refugees, drawing on different sources and people that resonate generally in society has been helpful without replacing the need for a legal status of refugees and the need to protect asylum here.
No, thank you. I really appreciate your kind of looking at religious culture and other entry points. Entry points in an influencing strategy is really crucial, wherever one's context is, to be able to find the right door to really kind of bring into society, public opinion, decision makers, and government. You mentioned about your teams also and the staff. So I would like to ask you, I mean, protection leadership also means about supporting and empowering your own team, guiding them, but also making sure that they take a principled approach, at times of complexity and pressures, which is not really always easy to do, and making sure that everybody is also risk aware about these protection decisions or messages and whatever is made. So how do you go about your own team in terms of providing protection leadership and guidance to them?
That's an excellent question and obviously very timely. I think more than nationality, what you look for in staff and when as UNHCR, you know, we're posting staff in different operations, et cetera, more than nationality is curiosity. We need leadership that is curious. I think we need leadership that looks to staff, not just as resources, but as people who can actually evolve the way we work, how we work, etc. I've got a very clear example, and it's probably almost an extreme setting, although in today's world, today is pretty extreme, but I call it the theory of chaos. When I was in 2017 in Cox's Bazar, I was sent as the senior emergency coordinator to ramp up UNHCR's response to what was then the fastest growing refugee crisis Asia had seen in decades, the Rohingya crisis, people fleeing for their lives from Myanmar and then crossing over into Bangladesh. Within a few, I arrived, there were maybe 30 UNHCR staff, and within a few weeks, we were more than 100 and growing, 150 and still growing and 200. And in that context, if you are a control freak, I think you lose complete control. You have to let go of some of the control, allow a certain level of chaos for very real reasons. One, you need to trust that staff know their job. In such a big response, in such an emergency setting, with so many competing pressures, et cetera, you need to trust that a shelter officer sent by UNHCR knows what to do about shelter. You need to be clear that your protection staff know, you know, the ABCs of protection and know how to move with communities, et cetera. So trust of staff, I think, is especially important in an emergency, but all the time, and they need to feel it. I think, as I mentioned before, you need to be curious because staff in those situations can come up with the most incredible, innovative ideas. And you have to let them run with it a little bit to test their own ideas. So you accompany them, you get involved in the issue and try to nurture this and see what comes up. And we had some pretty tremendous innovative work that was done on shelter, especially before the onset of monsoons in Bangladesh that probably saved lives just because the construction had evolved and been innovated by staff themselves. And the third aspect would be, it's a cautionary note, know when to step in. Don't wait for high-level meetings or for colleagues to bring you in on a conundrum they're faced with. You know when to step in and say, okay, enough with the chaos. Now we put a little bit of order and the decision needs to be taken. So I think risk awareness is definitely part of this, but allowing a certain level of flexibility to teams to be able to let them evolve, let them come up with interesting ideas or ways of tackling challenges.
Thank you. It's really this allowing and knowing the limits and how to go. It's really important. Now, we all agree that collaboration is essential. No one entity, no one actor can do it alone. So in the influencing, the more collisions we build, obviously, the better it is. So I wanted to ask you, in your experience, what does an effective collaboration, for example, with civil society or with refugee-led organizations look like in practice? What are, you know, how do you find these effective entry points to make it work for you?
Probably a very illustrative example would be when I was in Niger, I was the resident coordinator and the humanitarian coordinator. It was my first assignment as an RCHC. I came straight out of UNHCR. So I used what I know best in UNHCR. We don't stay behind a desk as I am now. You get out there, you move around, you get to know different people, you interact not just with refugees, asylum seekers, you speak with the hosting communities, with local officials. You look a little bit at who is front line in responding to people's needs, etc. When you engage broadly, when you get around, it's known that you are open to engaging with different actors who perhaps at first sight don't have much to contribute to the situation. But later on, turn a page and suddenly you're very happy to have known them because you can call on them. What happened in Niger was very not a typical scenario, but things like that can happen. Overnight, a coup d'etat, we're dealing with a junta. And if I hadn't had this, the breadth of entry points in civil society from various shades and color of political leanings, if I hadn't engaged with different segments of society, youth groups, women's groups, farmers, herders, if I hadn't done this at the beginning, the first 2 years of my time in Niger, I would have had a really hard time after a coup being able to understand what was happening, the new dynamics, what people were thinking, and what they needed, what they planned on for the future. I had so many different perspectives shared with me. It allowed me to have a much deeper understanding of how to navigate. Bon, I navigated 3 months before I was excused by the junta. But nonetheless, those 3 months were critical. And like I say, I would not have been able to do otherwise. So if I were to adapt this or apply this learning to all the different positions I've had, I think you engage and you engage broadly and with meaningful curiosity. I think you convene and convene and convene, whether you're a UNHCR representative or an RC, there's always an expectation by civil society, by NGOs, even if they're hostile to you, that the UN convenes, that you bring people together, you coalesce discussion, dialogue to be able to understand the situation and be better prepared to respond. And the third thing I would say is, don't forget to give visibility when it's asked. NGOs that you don't fund contribute a lot and sometimes need recognition of the fact that they're working together with you to solve issues. Civil society is the same. Refugees or affected populations, you kind of have to ask. Sometimes it's not appropriate to give visibility to what they do more generally. But I think the aspect of giving visibility is something we need to keep in mind.
No, thank you. So you mentioned, of course, you're referring to your experience in Niger as a resident humanitarian coordinator. So if we come to this centrality of protection, kind of putting protection, people, safety, dignity issues on the table, how did you work with the senior leadership of the humanitarian actors in country? How did you work with the humanitarian country team, the UN and the NGOs, in bringing together a collaborative approach, maybe on one or two or maximum three issues that you consider to be the top priority for the people that you are serving?
I learned a lot in that assignment, notably about the development world. There's a notion that resident coordinators are first accountable to government. And as UNHCR, as a humanitarian, you deeply believe your first accountability is to people. And I have to say that really, again, saved the UN presence in Niger after the coup. Because we'd always had and adopted a narrative whereby the UN is there to serve the development from a human perspective, from the population's perspective, that the humanitarian work that had been ongoing, again, is not serving local authorities. It is working with local authorities, but the humanitarian dimension is very much focused on people. So even in my RC role, Panos, I think I maintain this idea that protection is central. If protection means keeping people at the center of your work, and that's how you speak. There was probably several moments as an RC, because don't forget, I was double hatting. I was RC and HC. So I had to explain the way I saw my work in various circles. When I was heading the UNCT meeting, I also had to remind of the centrality of protection, that we were there for the people, and that my work was to interact with government to align what people needed in terms of development, but for people, not to please government. And similarly, when heading humanitarian country team meetings, I had to dispel this notion that I was going to compromise. Because I've got an RC hat, I was going to compromise with authorities. And that was not the case, but I could use my entry points with authorities to bring about humanitarian response or access. I think if I were to encapsulate this, what I learned for anyone going in as an RC, you can have probably clear moral clarity in a development approach if you integrate the protection dimension. Yeah, I think that quite resonated. And I think in all of my postings, I would say that the combination, there are two ingredients that are required to mobilize beyond evidence. So we need the evidence part. We need metrics. We need tools. We need to be able to measure what we do. And that's probably the more rational part of the job. But combined with emotional intelligence to try to figure out what will mobilize actors to act, what will encourage different agencies to work together. This emotional intelligence with the rational, I think knowing how to use that properly, I think that moves mountains if we want.
Well, emotional intelligence and clarity. Really, I think this is kind of a guiding principle that should really be for every leader that works in the field. Now, some critics look at our sector, look at the humanitarian sector, and views that we have become far too risk-averse. In that balance, exactly what you're describing, many see that really we kind of no longer keep that moral clarity and courage to be able to really stand up with issues when they go very wrong. What do you think? How do you see it?
You speak to a tension. Like you can't deny that humanitarian actors have worked for decades. And we have, therefore, decades of learning. So the impulse there is what we see today. We've put this into policies. The learning we've put into standard operating procedures. So we document what we've learned, and therefore the temptation is to say, well, we've seen it all, so we just follow the same track in this situation or that situation. That's in tension with the other aspect of it, which is, well, actually every situation is arguably unique. Victims are different. Actors are different. Forms of violence and violations are inordinately creative, which is tragic to say. So things are always changing. So saying that, you know, our policies, our standards are all that will guide us is not going to cut it. I would say that to avoid seeing this as being risk averse and being too dogmatic, and to avoid throwing caution to the wind, I think there are a few things that we need to keep in mind. We need to know doctrine. We need to be very confident, comfortable in refugee law, in international humanitarian law, in human rights law. You need to know your stuff, but you ingrain this. You keep this at the back of your mind. Then you apply a little bit of the rule of chaos. You allow creativity because you understand that while doctrinally, their answers to everything, operationally, it doesn't necessarily match. So you need to allow people to think about, well, how do we apply in this situation, etc. We need to be both analytical and empathetic. We need to combine this to keep the mind open. Humility there is probably the best synthesis of rationality and emotional intelligence. That it's about being humble enough to be inquisitive, to listen, but also to know when you need to change course. I think at some times, as humanitarian leaders, as leaders generally, this idea that you may need to change a decision or change an approach, et cetera, it's not an admission of failure. It's an admission of there is more and better out there. So why don't we address the situation differently?
So principle and pragmatic, that's kind of the balance of seeing how to adopt it and adjust it and having your feet on the ground. Now, Louise, I would like to ask you, I mean, leadership is important at all times, but leadership is particularly important almost at difficult times, a time of pressure, almost crisis. Can you give me an example from your career where you took a decision, a difficult decision, for the people, as you say, that are the center on an issue of principle, and you applied it, and what results did you get?
There was a turning point for me, or like for fear of saying there was an epiphany. I was on mission in Central African Republic, and I was assisting, I was participating in a humanitarian country team meeting, and there was a very heated debate about what to do about these enclaved communities. And I say enclaved because they were besieged. The way it was described, we had these communities of minority groups completely encircled by armed actors, really, where there's an imminent risk of attack. They were besieged in that no food was coming in, no medicine was coming in, etc. And there was a very heated debate among the humanitarian country team about, you know, okay, so should we prioritize medicine? No, it's going to be so hard to bring in. Why don't we bring food, etc.? And it seemed that the central point was being missed. We had also reports from protection staff who were saying the communities are not asking for food or medicine. They're asking to be extracted. They're asking to be evacuated. So the main issue was being ignored. And I thought, why is that? Because it happens over and over. Humanitarian actors, we are so committed. So that we focus on everything that we can do. When the question sometimes is not what can I do, what needs to happen is the question. So if I can't solve it, there is a risk that I ignore that issue to concentrate on something I can do. There's a real risk there, as you can see. This meant life or death kind of situation. So removing ourselves and saying, wait a second, it's still about protection. We can't effect change, so who can? That question was raised. I raised the alarm. The High Commissioner was briefed, and the High Commissioner at the time sent a memo to New York and said, for this situation, we need real action, real quick, and not by humanitarians. We need political involvement and probably military negotiation to escort populations out of harm's way and an agreement as to relocating them somewhere. That required a political agreement between governments, because some of them were actually relocated outside the Central African Republic. And we needed military escorts to keep people safe while they were moved. So you can see that it was a humanitarian issue in that it was about the centrality of protection. But what people were asking was not being listened to because we didn't feel we could solve the problem. Panos, it happened several times across many humanitarian situations where the imperative of humanitarian assistance sometimes narrows our view of what protection really means. And in that case, I'm pleased and relieved to say that it was a bit of a game changer. You might recall the humanitarian upfront kind of initiative, etc. This is all born of the recognition that protection, as expressed by people in terms of what will keep them safe, can be very different from what humanitarian actors can bring at any one time.
Thank you, because your example is excellent, because sometimes we find ourselves in a situation where what is required goes beyond our work, beyond our mandate or capacity, or we may not be the best position being in the capital or in the country to say it. So mobilizing New York or Geneva, sometimes other capitals, and how to bring it forward, connecting the political with the humanitarian, with the development, is really crucial. So it is really important. Looking back at your career, and you've had a long career and a very rich career, what advice would you give to resident humanitarian coordinators, or to UNHCR reps or other reps, for the matter of fact, leaders in the humanitarian sector, in terms of the influencing skills, how to go about it?
Well, if I'd listened to my own tips, I probably wouldn't have so much white and gray hair. Here's what I've learned, and I think this applies to any context. It's about, you know, how do you exercise this leadership? I think first, check in with your level of passion, passion for what you're doing, passion for the situation, because you're never as credible and powerful as when others feel your conviction. When it's grounded, of course, we were talking about that balance of rationality and empathy. So check in with your passion. You need to be passionate about where you are, what you're doing, and what needs to be done. The second one is be humble, but decisive. You need to listen to people. You need to learn from people, but have the honesty to decide, sometimes in a manner that won't be unanimous. Anytime you decide something in humanitarian settings or as a leader, you never unanimously applaud it. So there'll always be this. And I think this is the lesson, is that what's required is decision, not perfection. So you need to listen. You need to take in as much information as possible, but you need to decide. And that decision needs to be timely. It needs to be clear. You need to be very articulate about why you took that decision. And then the honesty is about, well, maybe you need course correction down the road, because, as I said, nothing's perfect. And the third thing is, I'll probably pick up from what I said earlier about moral clarity. You're not always right. It's a hard thing to accept when you go up the echelons of leadership and grade and of responsibility. You're not always right, but you can be confident. I've maintained my confidence when I've had protection as my compass, because protection is this reminder that I'm not doing this for me. I'm not doing this for New York or Geneva. I'm doing this because I'm expected by people. People have said what they wanted, and that's what keeps me focused. So again, coming back, it's not what can I do. What can the mandate of my agency do, or what can I do because of funding? The question is what needs to happen, and that's the moral clarity. Then you harness everything in the system to try to make it happen. Donors, development actors, military actors, etc., to get it done. So if protection is your compass, I'd probably say you'll be a very influential, hopefully impactful leader.
That balancing act of so many considerations on how to bring it together. Thank you for your words of wisdom. One final question I want to ask you. How do we make sure that protection is everybody's business? We see often that protection is not always prioritized. So how do we make it everybody's business?
Well, if you're not prioritizing protection, I sometimes asking myself, what are you prioritizing? Because prioritizing protection is and means that you've understood the root problem faced by people and their communities. So in practice, it means you're focused on preventing or reducing risk for people in a conflict, disaster, displacement setting. Keeping protection as your priority, as your central focus, means you're probably not limiting your understanding of humanitarian responses in terms of sectors. It means that you have a broader notion of what different experts, expertise, experiences bring to people's safety, people's rights, people's dignity. So maybe I'm reversing the question and saying, you know, to do your job well, you do have to focus and prioritize on protection. And it doesn't mean forgetting anything else. It just brings things in sharper focus. And something I didn't mention earlier is that as a humanitarian actor, as a leader in the UN system, well, you cannot abdicate your responsibility. And there is a responsibility to monitor and address protection issues. And that is something that we all have to be cognizant of. So how can I make sure that leaders prioritize protection? Look at your job, make it passionate, convene, focus people, and listen. Listen, 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 and decide accordingly.
Louise, thank you so much. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for sharing your words of wisdom from your rich experience having worked in protection. It's been an absolute delight having you with us and really hearing your stories and bringing to life really protection leadership in the best possible way. To you listeners, I hope you found this conversation useful, practical. Well, thank you for joining us. We're looking forward to having you with us in future episodes of Protection Leadership. If you have any questions, reflections, or comments, please write to us. You can find us at the GELI website, which is www.geli.org/contact-us. Thank you and looking forward to seeing you next time.